Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. This episode features the portfolio co-managers of Fidelity Global Natural Resources Fund, Joe Overdevest and Darren Lekkerkerker. Joe and Darren will be doing a deep dive into their thoughts on oil and gas, precious metals, agriculture, and more. Joe, who is also Fidelity Canada's Director of Research, notes that oil demand was hurt through COVID, but the cyclical recovery is now being felt through the oil and gas industry. Additionally, looking at commodities, Joe notes that commodities can offer protection against inflation. And Darren explains to host Pamela Ritchie that he is bullish on agriculture, which had a strong cycle 20 years ago and then was ignored until late last year. Darren will also share his thoughts on electric vehicles and the associated demand on metals used in EV batteries. This podcast was recorded on March 18, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
There's a view that inflation and commodities are positively correlated, and inflation generally means the economy is improving, which can, of course, be a structural tailwind for goods like oil, metals, and chemicals. Tie the inflation angle to the broader topic of commodities through 2021, and to highlight where there might be opportunities, particularly for Canada, we're joined by Darren Lekkerkerker and Joe Overdevest. Darren and Joe are portfolio managers on many mandates, but they're also co-managers of the Fidelity Global Natural Resources Fund. Darren and Joe, welcome to you both.
Thanks, Pamela.
Welcome. Great to see you, Pamela.
Great to have you here joining us. It's a great topic to discuss. Darren, I'm going to begin with you because I want you to kind of set up how we got here to an extent. Obviously, there are all kinds of things that are related to the virus itself and the economy shutdown that is related to that. Did commodities and where they're going right now sort of come out of that, or was there a setup for it pre-COVID?
You know what, Pamela, when you ask me that question, I think back to the last time we had a really strong cycle or a super cycle, which was in the mid-2000s. I became Fidelity's metals and minings and agriculture analyst in 2006, right when the super cycle was kind of shifting into higher gear. So it was a lot of fun from my perspective at that time. Why did that happen? So number one, you had really strong demand, a step change higher in demand driven by urbanization and industrialization of China. And then you had also strong demand from the rest of the so-called BRICS. I haven't used that acronym in some time. And then you had really tight supply. You had underinvestment for many years in the supply chain of mines. And it was asked to kind of restart. And one of the anecdotes someone told me was it's like someone who's rather lazy, they're on the couch, they're eating pizza, they're drinking beer, they're watching movies, and you go ask them to run a marathon, it's difficult. And then you also have the softer US dollar. And so today you think about that. And so commodities peaked in 2011. Since then, we've had relatively low prices and we've had underinvestment in the sector. And now we had COVID whereby demand was completely washed out, prices went significantly lower, and we had relatively lower production last year. Some of it is directly due to COVID and also lesser investment. And then you had China come back, right? China came back first. And we saw strong imports from China in terms of copper and corn. And then now we're starting to see the U.S. come back and we're seeing strong demand in the U.S. Europe, I think, is still a little slow. And the big kicker this time that I think people are really excited about is decarbonization. And what does that mean for commodities markets? Well, for the metals and mining, it's very positive because of the demand for copper and nickel and lithium for electric vehicles and for renewable power, like wind and solar. And then, meanwhile, also the supply chain looks pretty tight, as I mentioned. And I think the U.S. dollar went a lot higher in March of last year in terms of a risk-off trade. But if the if you see a global economic recovery, the US dollar tends to be countercyclical. It could be a little softer and act as a tailwind.
It's so interesting because it's, you know, everything that it was last time, plus a whole bunch of new things as well. Joe, I want to ask you actually about renewables and how that plays into everything, but I actually wouldn't mind you giving us a bit of a scene setter, if you don't mind, on oil and specifically on OPEC Plus and sort of the U.S. oil producers. And there's a detente, so no one's flooding the market right now. They're keeping the prices. They're trying to keep the prices where they are. The question for investors seems to be, how long does this hold? How fragile is the detente? You look at this. What do you see?
There's a number of things going on, actually, Pamela, and I'm glad you asked that. Obviously, supply and demand, it always comes down to. Let's do demand first, because it's the more simpler one, ironically, is that demand was definitely hurt by the COVID impact. So there's a cyclical recovery going on just because people are going to start moving again, start flying again. And so the cyclical recovery across all commodities is definitely being felt in oil and gas. Now, you may mention, of course, another one I'm sure we'll get into is renewables. There's a secular headwind, though, on oil and gas that is not apparent in, of course, many of Darren's stocks in the material side. It's actually a tailwind for him. That's one of the flexibilities of this fund. We are seeing a secular headwind, and you know, right now those are two fighting forces, and definitely the cyclical recovery is benefiting oil and gas on the demand side. Supply really comes down to two things. We'll talk about a lot about both. Obviously, the U.S. production, they're holding back right now because investors are telling them, please don't add rigs. But you made a very good mention of OPEC. OPEC, last, you know, about a year ago, just before the pandemic, they disagreed. Russia and Saudi stormed out of a room. They flooded the market, and then the pandemic hit. It was the worst timing ever. That has totally changed on its head a year later. Russia and Saudi Arabia, as of now, are getting together. But that's one of the toughest things that when we look at oil and gas, you have this OPEC that can change your mind at essentially any time, whereas metals or lumber, you don't have that kind of risk. And so it's something we definitely look into. We look in the supply and demand or the relativeness of one commodity versus the other.
Kieran, sketch out for us, you know, sort of what the fund is, you know, is looking at right now. You seem to have a lot of options, actually. How you want to just sort of go to that and how the positioning is reflecting that?
Yeah, you're right. So let's start with copper. And so copper, you know, bullish on copper fundamentals. I think demand is strong, as I've kind of broadly outlined for commodities, and it gets a big secular benefit from decarbonization. And supply, there is some supply to be added, but I think it's relatively tight. We will need some supply for the market. And so I think for these producers, I think they can enjoy a couple of years, maybe longer, of high prices and produce a lot of free cash flow, which we really like, obviously, as shareholders. Another area that I'm really bullish is agriculture. And so I think agriculture, we had a really strong cycle in the 2000s. I kind of feel like it ended around maybe when BHP bid for Potash Corp Saskatchewan, I think it was 2012, and I kind of largely ignored agriculture until sort of later last year. And I think what changed there was China 2 years ago, their herd of hogs was decimated by a virus, the African swine flu, and now they're rebuilding it, and they've had to have very strong imports of grains to feed the herd. And so that's something we're watching carefully also to make sure that there's no new virus there that could disrupt things. But it looks pretty good for the next couple of years. And I think fertilizers is a big benefit there as farmers try to produce more and take advantage of high prices. Another commodity that I probably talked a lot about last year was lumber. And so anyone who's watching, who's tried to do any remodeling or renovation work or is buying a new home is painfully aware of really high lumber prices. And it's something that I think you know, they're kind of peakish, but I think they could be stronger for longer. And these companies could generate a lot of cash flow as there's limited supply and the demand outlook for housing looks really strong. And then I think there's also chemicals and probably tilted more from specialty chemicals to commodity chemicals that the companies probably produce a lot of cash flow when you have high prices. And then some of the other things I'm focused on too. Is some of the newer sort of battery metals like lithium.
So we'll dig into that in just a sec. Joe, I wanted to come back to renewables a little bit here, and maybe you begin it with sort of, as you said, the headwinds really that traditional energy might face and where that leaves renewables and where you see, where are we in that right now? Sort of love to get your thoughts on if there is a cycle here or which point we're at. Are we very much at the beginning?
For renewables, it seems we're actually in the beginning. It doesn't mean the stocks are going to be, you know, continue to go up. They're going to probably have fits and starts. The actual renewable demand that is coming from corporations and governments and individuals seems to be in infancy. When you look at especially the U.S. or Canada versus other regions around the world, even China is leading this. Where again, if we had this discussion 10 years ago, you know, you wouldn't hear China talking too much about renewables. And of course, Europe is definitely ahead of us. And so that is probably early on, and what will speed this up will be technology. All of a sudden, if there's a technology breakthrough. Number two, though, carbon costs. If all of a sudden the government start taxing carbon, that will flip demand there. And then last, I would say is cost of capital. Liz, right now, this is very difficult for oil and gas company to find cost to fund debt or equity. Is very difficult. Let's just say not impossible, but a lot more difficult than it was a few years ago. Whereas your renewable company, your cost of capital and cost of debt is substantially lower on the margin. So that should help speed up this process, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, I'll just add on to that, Joe, for a second, because one of the questions coming in here is, you know, what are valuations like for natural resources? Are they cheaper relative to historical averages? As you say, renewables, you know, are new to an extent. I mean, there is some precedent looking to history, but I just sort of bring it back to valuations and where we are. We're at the beginning of probably something big, as you mentioned, but what are valuations like to you right now? A lot of them have gotten a huge uptick in the last sort of 3 to 6 months.
On renewables, this is a perfect example where you really have to watch. I think where we are in this cycle, sadly, you get a lot of companies that go public or companies that get on the radar screen of investors that are not great companies, right? Everyone has the next hydrogen play. Everyone has the next, you know, weird play taking some kind of substance and making renewable energy. And there are science experiments that would never be funded even 12 months ago. But now everyone thinks that the capital markets are open. So I think this is where I would just watch for investors, these ETFs sometimes especially, because they drive the valuations up because there's a few renewable plays out there. These ETFs just have to own renewables, and they keep driving it without any kind of price consciousness. And so I would, for ourselves, we're being very, very careful of the renewable space. Does this person have a track record? Does the CEO, CFO, you know, have they run successful companies in the past? What is the technology like? Are actual companies using it, or corporations? Like, what does their client list look like? Because I definitely think there could be a shakeout here. Even though the band is very strong, doesn't mean I could see a lot of these companies having some hiccups as we get going here.
Darren, one of the questions coming in kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier. So what are your thoughts on rare earth metals, the upcoming need for them in batteries as the world moves to EVs? You touched on this. I guess I'm sort of interested in your thoughts on almost the scarcity there. I mean, the whole world is ready to move to EVs. It seems like the, you know, the model is there. Everyone expects it. Do we actually have the materials to make this all happen in the expected amount of time? How do you look at that?
Yeah, great question. So I think in the past week, Volkswagen and BMW have done investor days on their electric vehicles, and what they both came out with, like, big targets. I think it was 50% of vehicles produced in Europe for one and overall for the other by 2030 would be electric vehicles. So that results in a huge demand for these metals. So I think it's broadly bullish for all of these metals, which is like copper, nickel, lithium. Rare earths go in many things. I think I think broadly on the battery metals, I think we're bullish because we see like a big, strong demand trend. And then on the rare earths, I think that goes into many things. I think there the argument is more that almost all the supply is in China. And as China continues to industrialize and ramp up, people are concerned that there may not be supply left for the rest of the world. And so I think that you're seeing prices bid up there to encourage new supply. So there's limited opportunities there, but it's somewhere that we're looking as well.
Joel, I'll ask you to comment, sort of taking what Darren just said, but also probably expanding it out just on inflation generally. It's an inflationary environment, according to a lot of investors. There's still some data that probably needs to be seen to confirm that, but there's lots of reasons for a chunk of investors to believe that that's the situation we're in. How do commodities fit with the inflationary picture?
If we do see an inflationary environment, I think Jeff Moore, I think, did a very good show just recently, obviously, and commented a lot on this. And Urien, I know, comments a lot as well. If you do have inflation, commodities generally at least give you some protection up against inflation, of course, because generally in inflationary times, almost many commodities do quite well because they hold some kind of purchasing power, at least. And you can raise prices. And whereas other companies, of course, will see inflation on their costs and they can't raise the prices because their goods maybe not be in the same demand. And so if we're in that environment, yes, the commodities should benefit for sure.
Darren, do you like gold where it is right now?
Gold's not my favorite, Pamela. I think with the economy recovering, expecting a stronger economic recovery, I prefer the industrial commodities. They've got pretty tight supply, as I mentioned, and I think they should benefit more. I think in terms of gold, I think gold does well when you have negative real interest rates. We're seeing nominal rates move up here a little bit, which competes with gold as gold produces no cash flow. So the holding cost, you can think of it as the holding cost of gold increasing. Gold would be a big beneficiary of structural inflation, as kind of Joe just touched on in his earlier answer. So it's not something that we dislike. It's just not as preferred as the industrial commodities.
Anything to know about with Bitcoin there? Is it challenging gold in your mind?
I think it is, right? I think so. I think if you're older, you probably buy gold. And if you're younger, you probably buy Bitcoin. And so I think both of them are like, I mean, Bitcoin, some people refer to Bitcoin as digital gold, right? Because both of them theoretically benefit by the debasement of fiat currencies. And so that's one argument to own both with all the money printing going on in the world today, that it should debase fiat currencies like the US dollar and therefore put your money in hard commodities. And currently, like all the commodities we are discussing would benefit, as Joe outlined in his answer, but I think gold and Bitcoin. I think the other secular argument for Bitcoin is one of technological advancement and demographics, just younger people investing there. So it's not something that we have exposure to in this fund, but I think from the perspective of gold, as per your question, it is a little bit of a secular headwind as some demand that would have gone into gold goes into Bitcoin.
Joe, anything to add to that? You and I and some other analysts did a real focus on Bitcoin. Is there anything to sort of add to the overall picture here vis-a-vis the commodity story?
I would say Bitcoin, you know, there's a lot of things driving it. I think just a Darren thing, Darren made a very good point. We don't think it's a major driver of why like gold is not doing well recently. But it definitely is a secular headwind. And the reason why is the gold market. When you look how many dollars it is a huge market. I know Bitcoin's moved a lot, but it's nowhere near in terms of probably impact at this point in time. But I think it's something, you know, to bear watching. I would say though, like, as we talked about in our other presentations, and even Jeff Moore mentioned recently, the volatility of gold, the volatility of Bitcoin is so extreme. You think gold is volatile, you know what I mean? And so with that, the kind of investor that generally goes to gold, going to Bitcoin, is usually not a clean process. As Darren correctly said, a lot of times it's a new investor, maybe a younger investor who never owned gold, who isn't going to gold, but is starting off with Bitcoin. And I think that lowers the market. If Bitcoin's volatility came down, I think it'd be a little different argument, but now it's almost like it's playing a number of purposes, a technology change, it's someone's view on, you know, an adoption of payments as not just a store of value.
Fascinating. I know it's an area you're both watching. Darren, question coming in, this probably is for you. Does uranium come into the ESG story? There's some thoughts on this. How do you sort of frame this?
Joe is actually the one focused on uranium, so I'm going to flip it to Joe.
Okay, Joe.
Yeah, Pamela, this is a tough one. Uranium, you think it goes either one. Officially, it goes to me. So you flip the coin, you're wrong, but it's okay. So on uranium, it's a tough debate that we even have. Is it ESG friendly or not? So if you read, which I thought was a pretty decent book, very recently Bill Gates put a book out on climate change. What do we need to do? What do the governments need to do? His argument is, we need many solutions, and you need uranium because you just can't replace all the oil and gas in the world in any kind of reasonable time period. And so his argument, yes, uranium right now, probably not the cleanest fuel, but with new technology, it can be cleaner. But when you look at some of the major countries around the world, where their goals are, very few are saying we need to increase uranium, or nuclear. Some are extending nuclear power plants, but no one's really saying I'm going to start a new nuclear power plant. And many, when it comes to, again, ESG is a lens that we talked a lot about, it's everyone's lens is a little different. We find most investors and countries at this point in time, the way nuclear is being done is not ESG friendly to them. It's still, there's too many issues with it to get in that ESG bucket. But I guess the only thing I would say is, you know, something we watch for technology wise, if it changes drastically and the negatives of uranium can be, you know, offset, that would be different. But right now, it doesn't seem to be a clean view for an ESG friendly product.
Aaron, considering everything that we're discussing right now, it kind of sounds like it's a pro-Canada moment. Is that fair? I mean, do you look at it that way? You invest across North America. We've got this kind of cyclical trade going on right now. How does that bode?
I think you're right, Pamela. I think things are set up pretty well for Canada and the Canadian stock market and equities. And so you're alluding to my Fidelity North American Equity Fund and where I invest in both the US and Canada. And I would say that versus 3 months ago or 6 months ago, I've got a higher weighting in Canada. It's more bottom-up driven. I've just been finding more interesting opportunities there in some of the themes we're discussing, like materials and energy, but also in industrials and Canadian financials.
Right. Okay. I'm going to put this next question to both of you. Joe, are we in a commodities super cycle? Do you feel comfortable looking at it that way?
I think the commodities super cycle, the attributes we saw, for instance, the last super cycle, are not there right now. And so whenever we look at any kind of super cycle, being commodities or even like homes or any kind of asset, usually it's constrained supply. Usually it means demand is coming, and we can't get supply quick enough. The last cycle, as I think Darren elaborated very well on, you had the BRIC countries. I can't believe we're using the word BRIC again.
O'Neill, right? Is it O'Neill? Who said that?
Yeah, it's very good. Very Goldman Sachs. So we're back. The BRIC countries were driving demand. There was a secular change in demand. That's a key word, a secular change in demand. And supply couldn't keep up. And I will let Darren talk about the metal side because it might, you know, it's always a little different. On the oil side today, though, then it was OPEC was going full tilt. They couldn't keep up. And then the other really big driver of oil, that super cycle was oil sands. But those projects take 5-7 years to come on. Well, that's changed today because now the supply is still OPEC. They have a large amount of capacity they can put on the market. Number two, though, OPEC is not oil sands. The biggest driver of supply outside of OPEC is actually the U.S., and they can bring on supply in a few months. So that's a big difference there. So as demand goes up, they can match supply pretty quickly. So I think this is more from an oil side, a cyclical recovery. Doesn't mean it can't be a pretty positive recovery, but the attributes of a secular trend in demand and someone holding back supply don't seem apparent on the oil side.
Interesting. And you have the flexibility in the fund to sort of move as you see the opportunities there and perhaps then fading or however you look at that.
Yeah, exactly. Now that's what I'll lead to Darren. I think from our perspective, we talk a lot. I think some of the better attributes across commodities, again, the oil has some great companies as well, but some of the more positive ones would probably be in the lumber and metal side. So I'll hand it back to Darren.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, actually, great. You kind of other thoughts on that, Darren, because we'll get close to the end here. But yeah, I want to hear kind of your thoughts on this so-called embarrassment of riches, like all the different options.
Yeah. So, you know, Joe and I, we probably tend to be a little conservative. So I think I'm not going to call it a super cycle either. I think that it looks like a strong cycle and where we could have strong commodity prices for the next couple of years, which could still benefit investors in terms of stronger for longer and these companies generating a lot of cash flow. I do think that there's a big difference in the fundamentals between the materials that I look at and the energy Joe looks at. And so I think that both demand cyclically and secularly looks stronger on the material side as well as the supply looks tighter. There's not a cartel with spare capacity on the material side like there is on the energy side. So I think fundamentals look strong. I think conditions are good. Fundamentals are good right now.
So here's a question that has to do with sort of, again, the global picture for commodities. Joe, decarbonization, and maybe we talk about, you know, various renewables within that, decarbonization seems to be a developed country phenomena. What are your thoughts on developing countries' demands for fossil fuels, you know, also and renewables? How do you look at that globally?
I think the emerging markets will be there. It's just something that, you know, sadly, they sometimes don't have the benefit financially to be a leader in that. But especially if technology changes, and probably some of this technology will be led by the developing countries, lower the cost of solar or wind, it will be adopted in emerging markets as well. Like, one of the simplest things is telephones were not very apparent in Africa, and they just skipped telephone lines, went right to cell phones because the costs were so low. That technology was brought to that country. So in areas where maybe even today there's not much in terms of energy, if all of a sudden solar and wind becomes a lot more affordable, they'll adopt it very, very quickly. So I think that's something that if the cost curve changes, the adoption can move very, very fast. And something that, again, we try to be very flexible in the fund, and we try to go, be it renewables, oil and gas, or metals, to where we find the best supply and demand.
Darren, do you look to various sort of global, you know, I'm thinking of sort of China and the U.S. There's potentially a meeting coming up in the next several weeks about, you know, whether they craft policy together on the environmental front, the ESG front. How closely do you watch certain things like this to kind of guide your investing? I mean, are these important connections to have, or are they happening anyway? What kind of global events do you watch?
Look, Pamela, no question the world is moving to one of ESG. And definitely the a clean environment is more prioritized today than it was, you know, a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And to your last question, one point I'd like to tack on is China. You know, look, it's still a developing country, but they outlined their 5-year goals like last week. And one of the key goals is to reduce the carbon content per unit of GDP. And I don't think it's just lip service. I think that, if you want to get promoted in the government, and even for businesses to get loans, like that, you have to outline your carbon output. So I think it's serious, and I think it is a benefit to the materials. I think in terms of the U.S. and China, look, I think we can say the Biden administration there, there's potential for greater emphasis on the environment and ESG, and two, a greater likelihood of working with other nations, especially China.
I want to thank both of you, Joe Overdeves and Darren Lekkerkerker, for joining us today. Fascinating topic. Great to get your insights, where you're looking within this overall topic and how the fund is positioned. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.